Making the links from Libya to Flint to D.C. to Haiti with author and activist Gerald Horn, plus side eye at election 2016. All that and more coming up. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for February 18, 2016 on 89.3 WPFW Pacifica's listener-powered station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. On the Ground Show and our website, onthegroundshow.org, are devoted to coverage of social justice activism on the streets and in the suites of power. Today, we're making the links from Libya to Flint to D.C. to Haiti with author and activist Gerald Horn. Well, 30 years ago this month, the ruthless Haitian dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier, also known as Baby Doc, was forced to flee Haiti. And then 5 years after that, the country's first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was elected. We'll be talking about this with Gerald Horn and also talking about Libya. There's lots of anniversaries. 5 years ago this month, the populist uprising, Western-backed, began in Libya, and it ended with the murder, the assassination of Muammar Gaddafi. So we'll be talking about all these things, and we'll be doing this during our Winter Fun Drive. We're talking about activism and telling our own story. And this is the hour for On the Ground to raise $600 for this week's goal to keep this listener-powered community station on the air. I want you to call 202-588-9739 or pledge online at WPFW.org to show your support for our coverage of activism here in what we call the belly of the beast of national and international corporate and military power. Our special thank you for this hour is one of Gerald Horn's new books, Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. We only had a few of these books to offer last fun drive, and they were snapped up quickly, so don't miss out the day if you wanted one of those books. And a few people called me afterward, and they were like, oh, where's my book? I wanted to get one, so don't miss out this time. Give us a call, 202-588-9739. So I want to get at least five people becoming a new sustainer or renewing a membership at only $10 a month to get a copy of the book or a pledge of $120. You can call that number, 202-588-9739, or pledge online at WPFW.org. But of course, no amount is too small or too large. If you can pledge for more than 10 a month, we would love that. We really appreciate it. All your donation goes directly to the station to pay bills, to pay the electric, to keep the office open, to keep the studio here, to pay the rent. So your money will go right to work right away. So as always, we have a lot for you in this less than an hour. So I'll start with our headlines. A 14-hour national marathon broadcast on the crisis of homelessness aired on several stations across the country, including here on WPFW, beginning at 7 p.m. last night and ending at 9 a.m. this morning. The special program highlighted the extent of the crisis in the United States, where it is estimated that 600,000 people are homeless. On the Ground, Chantel James anchored the 10 p.m. hour on mental illness, and Alan Banks of the National Coalition for the Homeless told her about the need for better mental health services.
When I first started my recovery from homelessness, I got pretty decent care from the homeless health system, but it was tremendously overwhelmed. I know I went one day and I was told to come back in 6 weeks. If I hadn't gotten to a point in my life where I was determined to fight for my life, I may not have showed up 6 weeks later. But I got to a point where I planned my suicide. And that's what gave me the determination to fight back and save my life. And, you know, a lot of people, when you tell them to come back in 6 weeks, it's not going to happen. You know, so we need a bigger system. We need more money in the system. I know that's a bad word, but that's what we need.
The number of homeless in the U.S. is based on government and service provider statistics about the number of people sleeping outside or in an emergency shelter or in a transitional housing program. D.C. residents were able to speak out on the issue of how the nation's capital will house its homeless at town meetings held last week in every ward of the city. The meetings were used to unveil the Bowser administration's proposal to shut down the controversial homeless shelter located in the former D.C. General Hospital and locate neighborhood-based emergency housing development in each of the city's eight wards. At the meeting in Ward 1, city officials said that it costs $17 million annually to operate the D.C. General Shelter and that the annual cost to replace that shelter is $22 million. Councilwoman Brian Nadeau spoke about the proposed site in that ward, which would transform the historic First African New Church and adjacent lot at 10th and V Streets Northwest.
We're bringing all the tools in the arsenal to this problem. Closing DC General and building these replacement shelters is just one aspect of that. So it's not a magic bullet, but we have to do this, and we have to do all those other things in order to resolve these issues. As your council member, it's my job to review the details of this project when it's submitted to the council, what sounds like tomorrow. But in the meantime, I'm excited about this project because I believe it fulfills the promise that we have all made in the five votes that we've taken in the past year to get us closer to shutting down DC General and providing temporary housing with dignity, safety, and security for our families.
Each of the short-term housing facilities would accommodate up to 50 families. The city proposal is called Homeward DC. In the latest on the Flint water crisis, the organization Food and Water Watch released a report this week that Flint residents were paying the highest water rates in America, even as their water was tainted with lead. The survey was based on this country's 500 largest water systems. On Capitol Hill, a proposal to send $30 million to Flint to help pay for water bills unanimously cleared the House Appropriations Committee yesterday and is on its way to a vote in the full House. Also yesterday, Pacifica's Democracy Now! Aired a special on the crisis, which included the fact that the Nestle Corporation is paying virtually nothing to draw 200 gallons of water a minute from aquifers in Mecosta County that feed the Great Lakes, water that is then bottled and sold around the world, including 2 hours south in Flint. Peggy Case, president of the Michigan Citizens for Water Conservation, is one of the activists who battled Nestle for more than a decade and won to keep the company from taking twice the amount that they are taking now.
So the water that Nestle is bottling here and elsewhere in our state is coming from the Great Lakes Basin. It is feeding here into Dead Stream and Cold Creek, then into the Little Muskegon River, that aquifer, and then eventually, ultimately, into Lake Michigan. So it's Great Lakes Basin water. It's part of the commons. It belongs to all of us. And part of the reason the people in Mecosta were pretty upset about it is that the extraction of that water was being taken out of the watershed. It was being the streams were being pumped down to the point where the Dead Stream looked like a mud hole at one point, and bottled and shipped all over the world.
Nestle's bottled water brand Ice Mountain is some of the water being sold and distributed in Flint. In other environmental news, Duke Energy is being fined $6.6 million for environmental pollution related to a big spill of liquefied coal ash in 2014. North Carolina environmental regulators said the fine is in addition to the $102 million in federal fines that Duke was ordered to pay last year related to the spill at the company's Dan River plant in Eden. Coal ash is the toxic residue left after coal is burned to generate electricity and contains toxic chemicals including arsenic, chromium, and lead. And yesterday, the Prince George's County Council's Planning, Zoning, and Economic Development Committee voted unanimously to pass a de facto ban on fracking in the county. The full council will take the bill up in early March. And some quick happenings, Apple is opposing a judge's order to hack San Bernardino shooter's iPhone, saying that it would create a backdoor that would make all its iPhones vulnerable to hackers. And after drawing a large police presence and cordon off sidewalks, a New York City protest prompted on Twitter to oppose Beyonce's Super Bowl halftime performance just didn't happen. None of the angry anti-Beyonce people bothered to show up outside the Midtown Manhattan headquarters of the National Football League. Instead, Black Lives Matter activists showed up to support Beyonce's artistic statement, which was an homage to Malcolm X, the Black Panther Party, and to today's Black Lives Matter movement. Some of those gathered spoke to reporters.
We're out here to protest the folks who are protesting Beyonce, but we don't see them.
They didn't show up?
No. So I think we're just going to, you know, love on each other like Beyonce wanted, and just continue to declare that Black Lives Matter.
We're going to break out because there's no haters here to hate on.
That's right.
Well, today during the lunch hour at 12:30, there will be a panel understanding the current Palestinian revolt, its context and consequences for Palestinian society, featuring policy analyst Phyllis Bennis and journalist Rania Khalek at the Jerusalem Fund, 2425 Virginia Avenue in Northwest D.C. And tonight at 7 p.m., Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, will speak at the ILH Auditorium, which is at 601 Howard Place Northwest. And that's on the Howard University's campus. She will speak about U.S.-Saudi relations and Code Pink's upcoming Saudi summit on March 5th and March 6th. Well, those are our headlines and happenings. We're going to go to a brief break, and during that break, you can call 202-588-9739 or go to WPFWFM.org to pledge online support to On the Ground. When we come back, Jamila Bay and Amy Alexander with their side eye on election 2016. Stay with us.
This is the new world order, and every drop counts. You can laugh and take it as a joke if you wanna, but it don't rain a full week some summers, and it's about to get real wild in the half. You be buying every yard, you take bath. Heads is acting wild, sipping boom, pumping dank, competing with the next man for higher playing rank. Right. Then I ain't got time trying to be Big Hank. The bank. I need a 20-year water tank, cause while these knuckleheads is out here sweating their guts, the sun is sitting in the treetops, burning the woods, and as the flame from the blaze get higher and higher, they say, don't drink the water, we need it for the fire. New York is drinking it, new world. The whole of California is drinking it, new world. Way up north and down south is drinking it, new world. Used to have minerals, is inking it.
Well, now our political analysts, Jamila Bay and Amy Alexander, are here with this week's side eye on election 2016. Take it away, Amy.
Esther, yes, thank you so much. We're happy to be here as usual. There's been so much going on since the New Hampshire primary, and we're coming up on the South Carolina, followed by the Nevada primaries. And so let's just do a quick recap in our side eye exploits. We've come to expect, you know, there have been more unseemly and astonishing shenanigans from the GOP side these days. Past few days have been very busy. But, you know, I want to say, usually I focus in on Trump, but I want to start with Jeb exclamation point this week, because there were a couple of developments that were really kind of astonishing in the story of Jeb's campaign. He's still campaigning despite dismal numbers across the board. But here's thing one. Early this week, Jeb grabbed his poor retired brother, George W. Bush, a.k.a. one of the worst American presidents ever, and he brought his brother out on the campaign trail with him in South Carolina, where the primary is coming up. And it was just, you know, the whole talk they gave didn't go over well. It was just sort of weird and just dispiriting that former President Bush was made to go out and stump for his brother despite lackluster numbers. It's a sign of desperation. But even speaking of desperation, signs from Jeb, exclamation point, a couple of other really bizarre things in the cycle happened. One was sad and unfortunate. On Tuesday night, Jeb tweeted from his official Twitter account a photo of a gun with his name inscribed on the gun, and he had one word on the overline of the tweet. The word was America. Went viral. You know, there's been a lot of commentary about it. I thought it, when I saw it on Tuesday night in my Twitter feed, I thought it was like a joke. I'm like, oh, is this like an Onion tweet? I couldn't believe it. So big side eye on that. That's my biggest side eye, because why would it turns out it was really from Jeb. But let's like listen to the clip and like hear how it kind of went over.
Republican presidential candidate Jeb Bush sent out a tweet on Tuesday that has gone completely viral. He posted a photo of a gun with his name engraved on it and simply captioned it with one word, America. Whether he or his social media manager meant to, the tweet has caused a lot of internet buzz. Some responses are calling out the country's gun control problem, and others are simply making fun of Bush.
So yes, for obvious reasons, as I said earlier before the clip, I give huge side eye to that because it's just, you know, the whole gun violence piece is so troubling. Another sign of Jeb, exclamation point, the desperation in his campaign, is that the Trump people redirected Jeb's internet domain name, and, you know, they now own it, and it redirects to Trump's site. This actually is something that lapsed. The Jeb people let the domain name online lapse, actually, late last year, but for some reason, this issue began circulating again this week, and there was a lot of chatter in the social media channels about, you know, if you go to JebBush.com, you get redirected to Donald Trump. And there was a message in there, and Trump tweeted behind it saying, yeah, I got you, basically. There was a GOP debate a weekend or so ago where Trump called everyone a liar, and then Ted Cruz said, no, I'm not the liar, you're the liar. They're like 12-year-olds. Fighting over, superhero comics or something. It's astonishing. So, in any event, my biggest side eye is for Jeb Bush tweeting a photo of a gun. It was an official Jeb Bush tweet on Tuesday. That's a big side eye because gun violence in America is no joke. So, that's my big side eye of the week. Jamila, what do you got?
Thank you so much, Amy. You know, I want to keep this week short and sweet because I am hell-bent on celebrating Black History Month, and this has been a pretty black girl magic kind of February. From Beyonce at the Super Bowl encouraging all the ladies, single or not, to get information with their cheddar bay biscuits from a certain primary-colored crustacean eating establishment, to all kinds of fun times with Olivia Pope returning to the small screen, black women are making political statements all over the place. And it seems now that women who look as I do are pretty hot commodities on the campaign trail in terms of making and translating statements. Even Donald Trump took a shot at hiring a black woman as his spokesperson. He targeted Tea Party darling Katrina Pearson. She had actually made her name campaigning for Ted Cruz, but as we have seen, the sister can accessorize. She's the one who made bullet necklaces newsworthy, you may remember.
Oh, bullet girl, yes. Bullet necklace, yes.
And then Bernie Sanders kept it close-ish to the family, even though she's not actually related. His spokeswoman, Simone Sanders, who had actually been an advocate for the treatment of youth in the criminal justice system, she's now the one who's getting out the message to those who would feel the burn. Finally, Hillary Clinton has hired attorney, political analyst, and full disclosure, my friend, Zerlina Maxwell, to focus on coalitions, including African Americans and women. So, black women, who are a force in national politics such that in 2008 and 2012, it was this particular voting bloc which assured Obama the White House, they're seeing their day in terms of political leaders who are making certain that the spokespeople they hire are able to speak to this most influential yet least actually represented demographic in national politics. So I'm not going to side-eye anyone except the two people who showed up to protest outside of NFL headquarters because they didn't like Beyonce's Super Bowl performance. To them I say, have a happy Black History Month, Esther.
Okay. Thank you, Jamila and Amy. And I'll be keeping an eye on what happens this Saturday in Nevada during the caucuses. Actually, it's neck and neck for Clinton and Sanders out there. And speaking of which, we're keeping an eye on our winter fun drive, 202-588-9739. I'd like to hear the phones ringing. Our goal is only $600. And I want to thank everyone for helping me to meet and exceed my goals for last year and for help us to go way over our goal last week, actually. All the money goes to the station to help pay the bills, to You've paid the electric, paid the small staff, and this is a labor of love every Thursday to come in and bring you this news about activists and activism. So 202-588-9739 or go online to wpfw.org to keep progressive media on the air in the nation's capital. Now, we'll be right back with remarks made by D.C.-based attorney Nkechi Taifa, and she was accepting a recent award from the D.C. chapter of the UNIA. Stay with us.
In recognition of her more than four decades of exemplary activism and community service in the District of Columbia, as a teacher, author, poet, and entrepreneur, for her resolute pursuit of human rights and criminal and civil justice reform, for her courage in the service of the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa as Minister of Justice, Council Chairperson, and Committee Coordinator, for her legal acumen in defense of political prisoners, as Commissioner and Chair of the D.C. Human Rights Commission, and as President of the D.C. Chapter of the National Conference of Black Lawyers, as founding member and co-chair of the Legislative Commission of the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America, Incorporated, for her indomitable spirit in the struggle for social justice, and her steadfast commitment to revolutionary Pan-Africanism. From the Woodson Banker Jackson Bay Division 230 of the University of Michigan Women's Association and African Women's League. I thank you, Mama, for all your men. We will face the murderous, cowardly
brotherhood resistant. We honor Nelson Mandela. He said, everybody supports their own liberation struggles. Us. We don't honor those of us who resist. Many of them are still languishing in prison today. After 40, 50 years, still languishing in prison, they resisted. They responded to the appeal that something must be done about all of this madness going on around here in this world. And members of the Black Panther Party went underground and then formed resistance movements, and they began to do something about all of this craziness. They began to do something about Black women being shot in Chattanooga, Tennessee. They began to do something about Black men's hearts being cut out in Buffalo, New York. I don't know if you all remember these things. These were some of the things, these were some of the reasons, okay, why the resistance movement in this country really rose. But when people who resist are captured, we forget about them. We don't honor our own freedom fighters. Suniata Okoli is still sitting in prison, the co-defendant of Hassan Shakur. Still sitting in prison. Sekou Ordega was just recently released. Geronimo Chikadaga, after a huge, long, decades-long legal battle, was finally released. You know, but there are people who are still sitting in prison. Tulu Shakur, still sitting in prison. We need to lift up people who did this. People who did fist up. Marcus Garvey was a political prisoner, people. He was a political prisoner. He still has not been, thank you, he still has not been exonerated. We must not forget that. Our children must know this history. My uncle, who was born in 1900, Mama McKean, was a member of the UNIA. My uncle, who was born in 1900, had shares in the Black Star Line. I didn't even learn about this until he was like 80-something years old. I didn't know, you know what I'm saying? But this is all a part. It's in our blood. It's in our veins. I'm going to really kind of stop, you know, here, because I do tend to get a little emotional. I'm kind of glad in the number of people who have left. I'm not that I'm glad, but sometimes you don't get the opportunity to really talk. Okay, you know, in this age, you know, your right hand, your left hand, you know, there used to be a time when folks didn't know about, they didn't know I was a minister of justice, what we do after, right. You know, I'm in law school. I mean, there's certain things I could do because folks didn't know what I was doing on the left versus what I was doing on the right. Honor those who resist. I'm not saying we all need to be out there and resist, but those who do, they should not be swept under the rug. They should be our heroes, our freedom fighters. We need to lift them up because they have taken the baton and done far more than any of us, even myself. So again, thank you very much, UNIA. I really, really, really appreciate this honor, and I'm very, very humbled by it.
This is Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition, in our second week of the Winter Fun Drive during Black History Month. I'm Esther Averam. You just heard D.C.-based attorney Nkechi Taifa accepting a recent award from D.C.'s Woodson Bay Banneker chapter of the UNIA. We're at our halfway of today's show, and I want to thank some people. So I need you to call 202-588-9739 to show your support of our coverage of activism and activists here in the nation's capital. That's 202-588-9739, or go to WPFWFM.org. When we come back, Professor Gerald Horn. Stay with us.
Every man got the right to decide his own destiny, and in this judgment there is no partiality. So harm you. to struggle, 'cause that's the only way we can overcome a little trouble. Brother, you're right, you're right, you're right, you're right, you're so right. We gon' fight,
we gon' fight,
we'll have to fight,
we gon' fight,
we gonna fight,
we gon' fight,
fight for our rights. Natty Jaded in a
Zimbabwe,
Kitty Dog.
If you're just tuning in, this is Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition, in our second week of the Winter Fun Drive during Black History Month. I'm Esther Averam, and I actually want to thank some folks who helped take us way over the top last week, and that's anonymous, two anonymous from Washington, D.C., Gary from Silver Spring, John from White Plains, Maryland, Anthony from Orange, Virginia, and an anonymous from Prince Frederick, Maryland. Thank you again so much, and I would like you to join them, listeners, this week by calling 202-588-0893 or go to WPFWFM.org. Now I'm happy to talk to Gerald Horn, professor at the University of Houston, author, activist, and frequent commentator across the Pacifica Network. One of his new books is Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. We spoke to him about the book in October, and we only had a few of books to offer during that last fun drive, and he was kind enough to offer us some more books that we could use for today's fundraiser and membership drive. So call 202-588-9739 while we're talking, and I won't take too many breaks to stop and pitch. Welcome back to the show, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, as we discussed the last time, your book talks about how not only did the leading powers, you know, France, Great Britain, and Spain, you know, suffer a huge beatdown, you know, during the Haitian Revolution, the Haitian Revolt had a profound impact on Haiti's mainland neighbor, the U.S., and that revolution inspired the enslaved here and struck terror throughout the southern slavocracy. It propelled the fledgling nation, the U.S., one step closer to civil war. And your book talks about this in great detail. And so I wanted to approach our second conversation about the book on Haiti and the Dominican Republic kind of from the perspective of today's underreported news. And I thought that, you know, we would at least acknowledge the fact that 30 years ago this month, the Haitian dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier, also known as Baby Doc, was chased out of the country. And it's been 25 years since the first democratically elected president, Jean-Patron Aristide, was sworn in. And we know that Aristide was then ousted in a CIA-orchestrated coup. So I wanted to kind of pick up our conversation about Haiti from kind of talking about these current events and these anniversaries. So what are your thoughts?
Well, my thought is that most recently you might have heard that President Martelly, Sweet Mickey, the crude and profane president of Haiti, is in the process of leaving office. and a colleague, a comrade, President Aristide, will be an interim leader. And to that extent, that is a significant step forward for Haiti. It was quite striking to see leaders of Lavalas, the party of President Aristide, at the State House in Port-au-Prince, most recently, within the last few days, and that shows that Haiti might be making a great leap forward. I should also say, with regard to your prefatory remarks, that the Haitian Revolution ignited a general crisis of the entire slave system that could only be resolved with its collapse, and that includes the collapse of the slave system in these United States of America. That is to say that those who are trying to understand the abolition of slavery on the North American mainland would be advised to look more carefully and closely at the Haitian Revolution as opposed to looking at what was going on in Washington, D.C. with the Emancipation Proclamation, which, by the way, did not apply to slave owners under the Stars and Stripes, only applied to slave owners who had rebelled against the United States. It was a war-fighting measure. And, in fact, as you know, President Lincoln was in the process of seeking to deport the African population en masse to Brazil, or actually to the Dominican Republic, if his wishes had been upheld. But fortunately, or perhaps unfortunately, they were not.
Right. Like, a lot of people don't know that. Can you talk a little bit more about that, and so that people really understand what you're saying, that there was a plan to, like, deport all of us to Haiti or Dominican Republic then, or whatever?
Well, the context is that I think the U.S. historians have not done a very good job of recounting the actual tale of U.S. history. U.S. historians, who tend to be liberals, tend to write about liberals and stress liberalism. You'd get the idea that abolitionism was a mainstream opinion amongst Euro-Americans during the antebellum period, and actually it was decidedly minority creed, particularly in Dixie. And I think that misreading also helps to misguide us as to what's happening today. That is to say, it becomes very difficult to understand why Donald J. Trump has such sizable support in the white working class and middle class communities if you follow the logic of U.S. historians who tend to stress liberalism. Now, with regard to President Lincoln, I said in an earlier book, The Deepest South, United States, Brazil, and the African Slave Trade, I went into great detail about how he had first thought that we would do better in Brazil, the largest country in South America, the country with the largest black population outside of Nigeria. But for various reasons, the Brazilians would not accept us. He considered Ecuador. He considered the Dominican Republic as well. Recall that, as I talk about in the Confronting Black Jacobin book, the Dominican Republic comes into being in 1844, not least because of a successful covert action engineered by the slave-owning Secretary of State, John C. Calhoun, who struck back at Haiti. That territory had been under the flag of Haiti up until 1844, and he helped to set up this U.S.-backed regime in the DR, and then was maneuvering to send all of us there. That particular maneuvering did not end after he passed away. One of his successors, President Ulysses S. Grant, was maneuvering not only to send us all to the DR, to the Dominican Republic, but had in mind the annexation of the entire island, including Haiti, liquidating Haitian national sovereignty. This was also not new, because, as I say in the book, one of the frights, one of the fears that Haitians were always looking at in the period leading to the U.S. Civil War was the idea that these folks from Dixie were going to invade Haiti and re-enslave the entire island and basically liquidate the promise of the Haitian Revolution.
So, of course, a lot in terms of current events also, Haiti and the Dominican Republic was in the news because of the very underreported mass deportation of Haitians from the Dominican Republic. And I was wondering, is there a way to view this human rights crisis through the history that you're describing in the book?
Well, absolutely. There is no doubt that there is a certain fear and hatred of dark-skinned people amongst certain DR elites. That was manifested as early as 1844 at the time of DR secession from Haitian rule. And it's also manifested, I'm afraid, on the face of baseball slugger Sammy Sosa. If you go to the internet and look at his pictures, you'll find that he's denuded himself of a good deal of his melanin. And in fact, has blue eyes.
And yeah,
Whereas previously he was as dark as I am. Now, this crisis that's unfolding on the border is also a manifestation of what we're talking about. That is to say that there are many Dominicans who are perceived as Haitians, even though they were born on the eastern side of the island in the DR. They have been expelled en masse. There are these catastrophic camps on the border between Haiti and the DR. It's a human rights outrage, and certainly we need to protest quite vigorously what's going on there.
Yeah, and where do you see any areas of protest around this? I'm just not hearing anything about it in terms of anything from any government official, in terms of this is something right here in our hemisphere, and, you know, just tremendous human rights abuses in terms of people not only being deported, but their belongings being taken away from them, their children being abused, you know, women being abused. I saw a news item about people being kind of given the lure of staying if they will, like, work off the books, basically as slaves, you know, under very inhumane conditions. So do you see any... Are there any locations of resistance, you know, that you noticed here in the U.S. or among other countries that could make a difference?
Well, I may have a distorted opinion because I've been speaking about this quite a bit and I've been hearing from audiences about this. And so I have the perception that in the United States in particular, there has been spirited protests about this human rights outrage.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, protests at Dominican consulates, particularly in New York City, and I've even heard about protests at the embassy in Washington, D.C., but once again, I may be too close to the situation and may be getting a distorted viewpoint. Certainly, the protests have not been sufficient to drive the DR regime away from its ill-advised policy.
Well, so I wanted to make sure that we... talked about a number of anniversaries, so I don't want to leave Haiti and the Dominican Republic too soon because that's what the book is about. But it's also been 5 years now since the, I guess, U.S.-backed uprising in Libya. And it resulted in the, what I call murder on YouTube, you know, of Muammar Gaddafi. And since then, the country has descended into chaos. Before he was ousted, Libya had one of the highest standards of living in Africa. It was a place where numerous sub-Saharan African people could live and work and without fear of being, without harassment and discrimination. And so, but since then, you know, there's been a tremendous crisis there in terms of people leaving. It's been a big part of this refugee crisis that has funneled up through Libya to the Mediterranean into Europe. So I wanted to get your thoughts about that. We can always go back to Haiti, but I just wanted to make sure we talked about that as a current event also involving, you know, the U.S., involving a popular uprising and what's happened to the indigenous people there.
Well, it's quite striking that CERT on the Mediterranean coast of Libya had been slated by Muammar Gaddafi to be the capital of the African Union. Today, it is the capital of the so-called Islamic State. Now, it's quite striking as well to consider that President Barack Obama got elected in 2008 in no small measure because of his platform promise to not repeat the mistakes of his predecessor, George W. Bush, in Iraq. And yet, he has done so,
right,
and by some measures, done so by an order of magnitude. Now, of course, we can castigate President Obama about that, but I think we'd be better served by looking at a broader picture because he'll be leaving office in any case and will be departing from the historical stage. That is to say that, once again, I think that you can't understand these kinds of disasters, these fiascos, U.S. foreign policy, without understanding the balance of forces in the United States itself. I mean, it's quite striking that some of Mr. Obama's most stringent critics, particularly on the Pacifica, actually attacked him with regard to the overthrow of Gaddafi in 2011. This suggests that we have some very serious ideological problems to attend to, and I'm not sure if we are doing so, which makes it very difficult for us to understand what's going on politically as we stare down the barrel of a possible presidency of President Donald J. Trump. I should also mention that I was just at the Pan African Film Festival in Los Angeles, and the director of the festival told me that during the regime of Gaddafi, he was working with Caribbean leaders, not least the Prime Minister Rosie Douglas of Dominica, the small Caribbean island, to fund revolutionary Pan-African films, amongst other Pan-African initiatives. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that went down the tubes after he was overthrown by U.S. imperialism and its NATO allies in 2011.
The fact that Obama is leaving office, of course, points to the fact that, you know, we have this election. I'm looking at the Democratic primary where Hillary Clinton's role in Libya isn't really discussed that much. You know, it talks about, I hear conversation about from the Bernie Sanders camp about her being involved in regime change, which leaves a vacuum that has allowed ISIL to grow and flourish. But I don't really hear much reference to her reaction after he was killed. I was really appalled when she was being interviewed and she was cackling and laughing and, you know, made some comment like, you know, we came, you know, something and he died. And it just seemed so unseemly for a Secretary of State. And I don't really see that reference much, nor just the overall policy in Africa in terms of regime change and the impact of on the people there.
Well, you are correct. It's no secret that in the early stages of this misadventure in Libya, that there was a split at the highest levels of the administration. On one side, you had the hawks, led by Hillary Rodham Clinton and Susan Rice, National Security Advisor, as of today, and UN Ambassador Samantha Power, that is to say, Ambassador as of today. And on the other hand, you had Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, who was a holdover from the Bush administration, was opposed. The fact that there was a split actually meant that President Obama had an out. He had an easy out. He could say, I'm following the advice of Robert Gates. And that's one of the reasons why I do think we have to personally castigate President Obama for giving the okay to disastrous misadventure in Libya. I think Senator Bernie Sanders also needs to own up to his misdeeds during that time. He came out for regime change, which Secretary Clinton pointed out in the most recent debate. And in fact, I'm happy to see that a person who calls himself a socialist is campaigning for the U.S. presidency and has gotten mass support. That's historically significant and profound. At the same time, I would urge Mr. Sanders' supporters to talk with him about some of the Cold War rhetoric that he's been involved in, not least in the last debate where he was speaking about Russia in tones that would have been embarrassing, perhaps even to Jeb Bush.
So I want to thank Onam from Virginia. Thank you very much for your generous pledge today. And I want to urge everyone, I have about maybe 5 minutes left, and I want to build on the success from last week and, you know, get some more new and renewing members this week for On the Ground. So please go to your phones, dial 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, or go online to WPFWFM.org. And I want to thank you before I get off the air. I had to come back during Chris's show last week to thank some more people, but I would like to thank you during our show. Gerald Horn is going to sign the book and send it to you. So that's a great gift for Black History Month. 202-588-9739. Or WPFWFM.org. So when we look at Libya and the fact that there's been this tremendous crisis there, I think I mentioned earlier, it's also, you know, contributed to this tremendous migration through the Mediterranean. And when I hear about the migrant crisis on most corporate media, they just basically talk about the Syrian refugee crisis. But I'm very clear that most of those boats are filled with people from Africa, fleeing war, destabilization, tremendous destruction of their communities and societies. And what are your thoughts on that? Both the coverage
Well, you are correct. That is to say that Libya, under the current non-regime, has become a major transit point for those fleeing conflict and destabilization in Africa, not least from Eritrea, the East African neighbor of Ethiopia. And this is also causing a certain political earthquake in Europe itself. That is to say, that it's strengthening the right-wing populist anti-immigrant parties, particularly in Germany. And you might even be able to make the argument that that has also helped to give strength to the right-wing populist anti-immigration party in the United States, led by one Donald J. Trump. I don't think that the mass media, so to speak, the so-called corporate media, has done an exemplary job in making these kinds of connections, not least because they seem to be reluctant to do a self-critical analysis of the United States itself.
The other new book that you have, and we'll definitely be following up on this in the coming weeks, is a book on Paul Robeson. And he's definitely one of my heroes. And I wanted to definitely bring in his legacy and the story of his life, at least briefly during Black History Month, because we normally talk about fascism and pre-fascism during this week of the show every month. And I know that much of his life he lived fighting against fascism, and that whole generation fought against fascism, not only abroad, but here. And I wanted to know if you had any thoughts that you wanted to just add as I wind up.
Well, just briefly, Paul Robeson, born in New Jersey in 1898, passing away in Philadelphia in 1976, in between an All-American football player, a star athlete, an NFL football player, actor, an activist, a star of stage screen, perhaps the best-known U.S. national, certainly the best-known Black American of the 1920s, 1930s, and through the 1960s, in fact. But, of course, he meets his Waterloo when he decides to confront U.S.-style fascism. Speaking of Jim Crow and lynching, a turning point in his storied career comes in 1946 when he confronts face-to-face then U.S. President Harry S. Truman and denounces him face-to-face for his lassitude in not prosecuting lynchers at the same time he was prosecuting Nazi war criminals in Nuremberg. Mm-hmm. From there, Robeson's income plummeted from the six figures to the low four figures. His passport was taken. He couldn't go abroad to perform. It took an international movement to have his passport returned. And certainly, I think we need to emulate Robeson, particularly in terms of his internationalism. That is to say, he was a master of speaking languages. He studied languages as a habit, spoke perhaps dozens of languages, including African languages, including Chinese, Russian, German, French, Spanish. So that kind of internationalism, it seems to me, is what we need to rescue us from this right-wing oligarchy that now controls the United States of America.
Okay. Well, thank you, Gerald, for joining me this morning and helping me to during this winter drive. Oh, I have another person to thank, Anonymous from Burtonsville, Maryland. Thank you so much. And so you can join Anonymous and Onam by calling 202-588-9739 or going on to WPFW.org to help us once again meet and exceed our goal. I've been speaking with prolific author and activist Gerald Horn, and we have his book, Confronting Black Jacobins, for our special thank you gift, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, as our special thank you gift for today. I'm Esther Averam, and I also want to thank Chantel James, Lydia Curtis, Michael Byfield, and DJ Wahid, and Jamila Bay, and Amy Alexander, and thank you for supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can keep calling in at 202-588-9739 or go to WPFW.org. There's a donation button on the upper left-hand corner of the homepage that says Donate Now. now. All donations will help keep your station for Jazz and Justice on the air. You can reach our show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice out there. Peace. Also, thank to Anonymous from Arlington. Thank you, thank you, thank you.